Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Alec Hughes, Senior Vice President and Regional Sales and Marketing Manager at Wells Fargo, and your chair for the program. Tonight's program is sponsored by Wells Fargo. It is also part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now to begin our program, I'd like to introduce Mary Bitterman, Chair of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club. Mary is also president of the Bernard Osher Foundation, a 34-year-old philanthropic organization in San Francisco that supports higher education and the arts. Previously, Ms. Bitterman served as president and CEO of the James Irvine Foundation, and before that as president and CEO of KQED. Mary will be leading tonight's conversation with Ambassador Hormel. Please welcome Mary Bitterman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alec, and many thanks to Wells Fargo for its continued support of so much of what we do here at the Commonwealth Club of California. It's a very special privilege for me to introduce our really exquisite guest this evening, James Hormel, former U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg and author of Fit to Serve, The Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador. I've had the privilege of knowing the ambassador since 1993 when I was selected as president of KQED and Jim was a member of the board of directors. I've been one of the many people over the past several years urging, if not nagging him to write this book, and because we also share a connection to Hawaii, I can now say publicly, mahalo nui loa. James Catherwood Hormel, born in Austin, Minnesota, the third son of Jay and Germaine Dubois Hormel, earned his bachelor's degree in history from Swarthmore College in 1990. No, he didn't. This is what we call a little typo, but we're going to let this go. In a very important time during the 20th century. He was awarded an honorary degree by the same institution, a wonderful, wonderful institution, in 2009. He received his a Juris Doctor in 1958 from the University of Chicago Law School, where he later served as Director of Admissions and Dean of Students. Before being named U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg by President Clinton in 1999, Jim was a member of the U.S. delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Commission in 1995. In addition to serving as chairman of the investment firm Equidex, Jim has long been an active community leader, generous with his time and wise counsel, serving on the boards of directors of KQED, the San Francisco Foundation, People for the American Way, Grace Cathedral, and Swarthmore College, among others. He also is a life member of the Board of Governors of the San Francisco Symphony and visiting committee of the University of Chicago Law School. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador James Hormel.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mary.
So let's start at the beginning. Some of you have read this wonderful book, some of you have not. So we won't presume that you've all read it, and I'll raise some questions while you begin writing down questions of your own and sending them up to me. I think for those in the radio audience, you really have to purchase the book because then you will see the really outstanding photograph of the ambassador on the cover. I think this is really just an absolutely handsome, wonderful, wonderful photograph. When we think about Austin, many people think about a place in Texas. But we're going to ask the ambassador to reflect on an Austin located in the great state of Minnesota, what it was like to grow up in a town where everyone knew the name Hormel, and to say a few things about that special place from whence he comes, and about the fact that it was rather more forward-looking than a lot of other towns its size, and largely because of some insights on his father's part. So let's just start a little bit with, tell us all here a little bit about Austin, Minnesota.
Well, Austin is practically in Iowa, actually. It's in the very southern part of the state, and it's very flat topographically. The city was approximately 18,000 people as I was growing up there, and those are 18,000 very enthusiastic, primarily Lutherans and German Catholics. That was the diversity of Austin. And it was a fascinating place to grow up. Also, the family name was pronounced Hormel there, and people referred to the company which employed so many of them as Hormels. So this was a company town, and my family had created the company. So it created also a separation between us and the rest of the community, which was very challenging for a small child. What made it more challenging for me was that for so long as I could remember, I was protected physically, because there had been, and please remember that I was born shortly after the Lindbergh case, there had been threats of kidnap. And so I didn't know a time growing up when there weren't guards someplace around. I was driven to school by someone in uniform, which is really not a way to assimilate. So there was our family, and there was everybody else, until World War II came along, and our family trebled in size because of refugees who came to live with us, including my two cousins from France, and other children of people in, mainly in England. So during the war, during the years of age 7 to 13, we had a very large household. And it was quite extraordinary because, as my father said, we had a total of 22 ration books, many of which spoke different languages. The experience of growing up that way was enlightening, broadening, and also restricting, because it sort of kept the compound a compound. So that was my early experience of Austin.
Say a little bit about your father and his some of the, I think, really innovative ideas that he brought to the workplace, especially in his treatment of his employees.
Yes.
How
well,
there was just a real sense of, you know, remarkable solidarity between ownership and workforce.
I really wasn't quite aware of this until I was pretty much an adult. But before I was born, in the 1920s, there had been an incident which created a very serious financial situation for the company. It was a major embezzlement. And in order to recover from that, the company was obliged to put bankers on its board for 10 years.
Heavens.
And at the end of that 10-year period, as we were going into the depths of the Depression, my father considered that it would be not only humanitarian, but practical to institute a program of profit sharing among the employees, and also a guaranteed annual wage. Now, the altruistic part of that is obvious because it was the Depression. The practical part was that the meatpacking business in those days was very cyclical. People worked very hard during the winter time, and they had nothing to do during the summer. So workers who had been trained and skilled in certain aspects of the job would tend to disappear and go elsewhere. Having a guaranteed annual wage made it possible for us to keep a stable workforce in Austin, Minnesota, throughout the year, and did not involve retraining or hiring new people all the time. Mm-hmm. And what it did for Austin was, I believe in 1938, there was a study which indicated that Austin had the largest percentage of home ownership of any city in the country. So it was a very successful experiment.
That's terrific. You were the youngest of three boys. Do you want to just share a little bit? There's some wonderful vignettes in the book about your relationship with your two brothers. But maybe if you could, for those who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, just do a little brief description of each. Brother number one and brother number two.
Yes, my oldest brother, which I don't say this in the book, my oldest brother was the favorite of his grandparents because he was named after his grandfather.
George, right.
And that really didn't make a huge difference with us because our grandparents had moved to California by then and we didn't see them with any great regularity. But he was somebody who was always trying to see how far he could push the envelope and to see how much he could get away with. And also to see how much he could persuade his younger brother, Thomas, my older brother, how much he could persuade him to do things that would get Thomas into trouble.
Oh, dear.
One incident was to build a fire. They were going to build a fire, Thomas was at this time. I think 5 years old, and Jordy said, let's do it behind the tree so nobody will see it. Well, they picked this wonderful shaggy palm tree. This was while visiting grandparents in California. And, of course, the palm tree went up in flame. And Jordy disappeared, and Thomas was holding the match.
Oh, dear.
That sort of illustrates each of them. Jordy was the one who created these incredible ideas that really challenged the social norms, and Thomas was the one who was willing to explore sometimes good ideas as well as bad to perfection,
and to stand responsible for what had occurred.
Yes.
When you were growing up, Jim, your goals as a youth, what did you see yourself doing in your adult life?
As I was growing up, I think I became more and more conventional because I started feeling less and less so. And I wanted to be liked. I wanted to please people. I wanted to do those things which I thought they expected of me. Not that they did expect them of me, but I thought they did. And I suspect that this is true of many people today. We think that other people have ideas for us, and we try to fulfill them.
Did you think about the fact that you would go and work with a company and remain in Austin after university, or once you went off to the University of Chicago, did you see yourself practicing law or staying within higher education administration?
Well, I never saw myself as an academic administrator. That was a big surprise to me and a wonderful gift at the time. It was difficult for me to contemplate going back to Austin then. It would be easier now, I think, given the nature of communication these days and how easy it is to be someplace that isn't a commercial center. But at that time, I didn't see myself living in Austin, although my parents did. And perhaps it made it easier for me not to be there when my father died when I was 21 years old. So I didn't have to deal with his expectations. I think that he would have been disappointed. I know my mother was. On the other hand, she was convinced that that I would be, you know, a famous person of some kind.
See, she was absolutely right. In the book, there are some interesting various anecdotes and just discussions of events which show a move politically from being both a Republican and seen to be a Republican and moving into a more Democratic orientation.
Well, I can't really talk about that without talking a little bit about what was happening with the Democratic and Republican parties at the time.
Exactly, and that's what I wanted you to speak to.
Yeah, we're looking at the period essentially between 1950 and 1965 or thereabouts. When, in 1965, Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he said, quite frankly, that he thought he was signing a death knell of the Democratic Party as people knew it. And there were droves of people who left the party then and migrated into the Republican Party. So the party which I knew at the time that I was going through college was the party of moderates and of people who were very proud of their founder, Abraham Lincoln, and who really were concerned about issues of liberty as they were expressed through various civil rights endeavors. And that party changed in a way that I simply couldn't. I couldn't embrace what I regarded as the lack of human concern that developed. The Vietnam War came along, and when it became apparent that we had been inveigled into a conflagration that we didn't belong in, I became an anti-war activist. And at the time, the social changes that were taking place, the sexual revolution of the 60s, emboldened me to take an honest look at my own sexuality and to consider how I had burdened myself terribly by the deceptions that I had created about being a conventional straight family man.
And you were a father and five children and a woman with whom you began to raise the children, for whom you have affection and respect. And it's really, I think, as people go on through the book and see the photographs of your family surrounding you, a very large family with children and grandchildren and whatnot at the time of your confirmation and swearing in. It was really, really very beautiful. Do you want to say a little bit more about the growing activity on your part and growing visibility within the gay and then the larger LGBT community as you sort of reflect on these transitions that you went through before we come to the ambassadorial challenge?
Sure. I need to preface by saying that my family has been extraordinarily supportive. My ex-wife in particular, I think, suffered from my deceptions in ways that would be difficult to describe, and came out of it in the most inspiring way for me. And I certainly would not want to go back and do life over without the five wonderful children who were the product of our marriage. So, but politically, I started exploring issues of social justice, and they had to include issues around being gay. They had to. And in 1969, when the Stonewall events occurred and received so much publicity, they were not the first, by the way, of the sort of uprisings, but they were the most publicized. I was living in New York, and I was drawn into the exuberance of the moment. It didn't last long, unfortunately, like so many other splinters. Gay groups started attacking each other rather than attacking the issue. And it took a while for the constituency to consolidate and unify. And during that time, that's when I moved to Hawaii and discovered there a wonderful environment. The first month that I was on Kauai, there was actually a weekend conference on what they called alternative lifestyles. And the very first morning of the conference was devoted to gay and lesbian couples, some of whom lived on Kauai, others who had come over from Oahu. And I was very impressed that the islanders were interested in how to accept rather than how to treat. And that was the spirit of Hawaii until the 1990s, when three couples chose to apply for marriage licenses. And when they were denied, they filed an action against the state. And the state Supreme Court was prepared at that time to say that they were entitled to those licenses. Then the forces of darkness brought to bear on the legislature, the state legislature, and Hawaii did not become the first state to authorize same-sex marriage.
Some significant changes in the composition of the population, too, over those years,
yes.
as you know. Because within the Hawaiian tradition, there's the great Mahu tradition, where some of the great chanters and the great people with the hula academies were leaders within the gay community going back long before the term became better known. Let's move ahead and look at the sort of character strengthening experiences you had once you decided, when people came up to you and said, you know what, you've done so much for the Democratic administration, you ought to be an ambassador. You ought to have some wonderful position within the administration or an ambassadorial assignment. And then you thought about it and thought about it, initially thinking, no, I probably have other things to do. And then saying to yourself, you know, this might really be something I should do. And I can do this, and I can sort of face more tribulations than other people because I'm from Austin, Minnesota. And because I have some standing, and I can do this. I don't think you ever expected it would take as long as it did, but please share with us some of the thoughts that went through your mind as you said, okay, I'm going to stand for appointment.
Well, it's interesting because it was suggested to me, and it was suggested actually before the election had taken place in 92, when it appeared that Governor Clinton was going to be elected. And his campaign treasurer at a dinner between the two of us suggested that I might consider a presidential appointment. And I said, Bob, why would I consider that? You know, I'm just another white guy on the list. There's no reason why he should turn to me. He said, well, you're selling yourself short, considering all that you've done for the party over the years, and there are people who have enormous respect for you, and I think that a position in the government would be suitable. He said, why don't you take a look? So I did. And as I considered the various options, it was an ambassadorial post that resonated with me because I had had a lifelong concern about international affairs. My French sounded a lot better than it was, but it wasn't bad. And I thought, well, if I were to seek an ambassadorial appointment, it would require Senate confirmation, and it would oblige members of the Senate to go on record for the first time on this sort of thing. So I think it was that last consideration that sort of pushed me over the edge, and I proceeded. I talked with Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi about it. She was encouraging. I talked to then-Senator Alan Cranston about it, and he said, well, if you choose to do that, I'll write your letter of introduction for you. So that's what happened on Christmas Eve of 1992. And that launched a process that was indeed 7 years longer than I had anticipated.
Several people have asked, was your heart set on Luxembourg? I think as you all read the book, you'll see that there were some other countries involved, but why don't you just at least say a word about, I think, Norway and Fiji and Luxembourg?
I had a daughter living in Norway at the time, and I knew Norway to be very progressive on social issues, so I figured there wouldn't be a problem on that end about my being gay. And please understand that I was an openly gay man since the late 1960s. Norway was kind of a first choice for me. When I said that to Nancy Pelosi, she said, well, you never know. She said, the president may have someone in his stable who would be, you know,
happy
on the primary
list. To Oslo.
And maybe not. Well, in fact, he did. His Wisconsin co-chair was a Norwegian, and that's where he was assigned. So I waited and waited and waited. Fiji came into the picture, not by any request on my part.
Maybe people were thinking it was closer to Hawaii.
Possibly. And as a matter of fact, I think that there was a question of whether John Wahei would like to be an ambassador
there.
Senator Akaka made clear that he did not want to go. But the governor was interested. I think he was running out of his term.
Yes.
And wanted that as something to do. Meanwhile, there was a public airing of the possibility of appointing me to Fiji. And there was a reaction on the part of the Fijians, partly because they had, at that time, the remnants of an old English colonial statute, which was referred to as the sodomy statute. And partly because there had been a colony of very active Methodist missionaries in Fiji who had convinced the population that this was not appropriate. So due to that resistance, I think the Fiji nomination was tabled until the 1994 elections when Jesse Helms became chair of the Foreign Relations
Committee. And so how did Luxembourg arrive?
Luxembourg was my idea. It wasn't a matter of choice. But in 1997, when I had served as a delegate to the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and I had served as a delegate to the UN General Assembly in New York. I thought I would just make one more play for an ambassadorial appointment. And at that time, of course, posts were mostly filled, but the one in Luxembourg apparently was available. And the country is a fascinating place between France and Germany, the home of the European Union, site of the European Court of Justice. There were American companies located there that I really wasn't even aware of until I started looking. For example, Goodyear has its European headquarters in Luxembourg. You'd wonder how they got a racetrack in such a tiny country, but they did. So
people are interested in what your favorite memories of your time as ambassador to Luxembourg. Certain things that you found very interesting, like the Goodyear plant is here, but other things, experiences with the people. I know that you traveled throughout the country, and even when you were being asked to wait until the Grand Duke returned to accept your formal papers, that you were encouraged and very much traveled around and talked to people and the rest of it. But what? Give us a sense of a few memories of your service that were very important to you. And
well, I guess first is that Luxembourg has extremely warm feelings toward the United States, extremely warm. As a result of the country being liberated by the U.S. Army, the Second Army of George Patton, which entered Luxembourg with the son of the Grand Duchess. And this was in September of 1944. Luxembourg was not occupied territory. Luxembourg was annexed to Germany. Place names were changed. People's names were changed. Luxembourg men were drafted into the German army and sent to the Russian front, or the most horrible places they could be sent. And in essence, the country had been robbed of its identity. So the U.S. Army was regarded as the restorer of that identity. And then in December of 44, in the Battle of the Bulge, again, it was a matter of the U.S. Army being there to win that battle. So I found this feeling, and the country, small as it is filled with memorials, which are observed on certain days all the time. So there was a lot of ceremony, and I was involved in it. There were the commercial interests, which ambassadors are much more involved with today than they are diplomacy, because we have instant communication, and it's not, you don't have to wait for the boat to come over to carry the president's instructions to you. So the commercial interests in Luxembourg were broad, and many of them were financial. There were, at that time, 212 banks in the country of a population of 500,000.
So that's quite a ratio. Quite a ratio. People are interested in what were your duties as ambassador? I mean, give us a sense of a normal day and unusual day. A fun day, a difficult day.
Well, a normal day included a ceremony or two. And I write about one that was especially meaningful to me. And a normal day would include meetings with the government to discuss certain issues that we shared. It would involve my concern about the security of the embassy, which was terrible. and my trying to get Washington to do something about it, which they didn't do until September 12th. It took September 11th to shake them up. An abnormal day included, a most pleasant experience was when I had a call from a young man in Minnesota who said that he was coming to Luxembourg to trace his family roots. And then he said, you may remember my mother. She died a few years ago. Her name was Ulwelling. Well, there are a number of Ulwellings in Luxembourg, but Betty Ulwelling was someone who was very dear to me, and I did remember her very well. And so her son came over and traced his roots successfully, and that's so wonderful. That's the kind of thing that just happened. One day I was called to the guard station, and there was a man in his 80s who wanted to present me with a book that he had created out of clippings, photographs, and other memorabilia of the Second World War. And it was so gratifying to me that he did that, with tears in his eyes, describing intimately what went on as he was a teenager, but too young to go into the army. So he went underground. It was fascinating to me how Luxembourg had been affected by World War II. Students in school learned both French and German simultaneously, beginning in first grade. The newspapers are printed in German. Everybody knows the language. Everybody reads it. Nobody speaks it.
I thought it was interesting in the book where you mentioned that just as the White House is to go forward with your appointment to the ambassadorship of Luxembourg, somebody said, and you do speak French, yes? And of course, your mother being from France, you did speak French and studied French, and that was altogether terrific.
Well, it helped me because my French accent is very good, actually. So I can say a few words and they think I really do speak.
That's very helpful. Let me just remind everyone listening that this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is the Honorable James Hormel, former U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg, and author of the new book, Fit to Serve, The Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador. What would you say was your proudest accomplishment as Ambassador to Luxembourg? Something that...
Well, that's an interesting question. The perhaps the most challenging situation I faced there was also a matter of security. There were several security issues that came up, but this one happened while I was away at a conference in The Hague about genetically modified crops and other organisms. Greenpeace took that occasion to come with a truck in front of the embassy gates and to dump 7 tons of genetically modified soybeans through the gate, blocking exits to the embassy, and meanwhile, the Luxembourg police sort of stood by until it was over, and then they took names. But that was about all that happened. Well, I had been a supporter of Greenpeace, and
but this was going too far.
this was, well, it was really a dangerous situation. Sure. Because not only did it block the embassy, there was a school across the street, a high school with 2,000 kids in it. And the dumping itself could have caused an explosion, a conflagration that would have threatened the lives of people around there. So When I got back from the conference, it was a weekend, unfortunately, that Monday morning I felt obliged to go to the Luxembourg police and directly confront them about their allowing this to happen. It was a very difficult thing to do. And I was probably not terribly diplomatic because I said things that were of immediate concern to me and should have been to them. I think that it sort of reinforced a relationship. Mm-hmm. And I felt much better about it afterwards.
One of our audience members wonders what your thoughts are about the recent WikiLeaks of U.S. diplomatic cables.
I have mixed feelings about it. And the negative feelings are that it was done without any selectivity, so that there may have been some very sensitive information that got disclosed and should not have been. On the other hand, it's routine for people in Washington to stamp everything confidential.
Eyes only.
Yes, it's just, it's absurd. And it prevents us from really understanding what goes on in our government from day to day and how we do relate or don't relate to other countries and other organizations. So that kind of disclosure has a definite upside as well. I don't know how one could be selective without reading all of the materials in advance.
Yeah. Which would take a discipline.
Yes.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on. We have so many questions about your very interesting life. I'm going to save one of my favorites till the end. but I think there are so many people at different ages, and certainly so many young people, who look to people like you who are seasoned, who have, you know, seen a great deal of the world and have gone through remarkable personal transformations. If you would share a little bit with the audience of your coming to terms with your own identity and your coming out in terms of your relationships with people and deciding that you really needed to take a fresh track. And whether in doing all of this there were moments where you weren't absolutely decided that moving this way or that way was the right thing, or did you reach a point where it was all perfectly clear that the road ahead, a specific road, was the road you needed to take?
There wasn't that clarity. And it would have been nice to have it. But I had started at such a young age to deceive myself that it became easy for me to deceive others, and it became more difficult for me to clear the air. I think that I could easily have identified my sexual feelings very early on, even before I was a teenager. And I've learned since that many, if not most, gay people would say the same thing. But I did not want that. That was not the universe that I saw around me. The universe I saw around me was a very heteronormative universe, which followed certain ways. And those ways seemed, you know, attractive, interesting. That was the kind of life that I opted for myself. So it took a very long time for me to work through that. And in 10 years of marriage, I did not work through that. I just succeeded in deceiving myself and deceiving my wife to the point where our line of communication had diminished to practically nothing. And I have to admit that it was Alice who caused the separation. Because of that, she didn't understand why things were as they were. And I couldn't tell her. So after she had made that choice, it was sort of like the bottom for me. It was when I hit my bottom and had to resolve to deal with myself. Well, having made that resolution, I came out to my brothers. They were two people whom I had confided in about other things, and I felt that I would just take a chance with them. And they were both very receptive and very accepting and very supportive. So that, in itself, lifted a huge burden.
I can imagine.
And I could feel that. I could physically feel that burden being lifted. So the beginning may be very difficult, but the reward is being true to oneself. And that is probably the biggest reward any of us can give to ourselves.
One member of the audience wonders if, in going back to Austin, the corporation employees were homophobic? Did people learn about your coming out and see you differently, or was that a place where you had much conversation about your life?
Well, actually, I was on the board of directors of the company at the time that I came out. And there wasn't a lot of conversation about it. And I think that people sort of chose to ignore it in deference to the family. On the other hand, when the ambassadorial process was in full swing and there was publicity, and nasty publicity, the company received letters, not from the community, but from other places,
yeah.
Which were not kind.
Say a few words, Jim, about, you know, we all want to think that the political life is service to the public and pro bono publico and all of these wonderful things. And certainly we have been graced with some extraordinary political leadership in the history of this great nation. But there were some particularly unsavory and unwholesome attacks on you, including even some elements of conversation related to your contributions to the San Francisco Public Library. Maybe you would just say a word about that.
Well, I can say a very brief word because it was very unsavory, and much of what was said was false. Accusations of being a pedophile don't sit well with me, especially when I consider my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. In fact, I find it patently offensive, the most offensive sort of thing. But then I look at what people are saying today about our president, you know, whom, you know, they accuse of being not even an American citizen, being born outside the country, not being entitled to be president.
But people from Hawaii know that he was born at Kapi'olani Children's Hospital, and we know one of the nurses who was there. So, but it is the accusations, and I think one of the things people looking at the James Hormel Gay and Lesbian Collection at the San Francisco Public Library, and some of the books that were there that are also in the Library of Congress,
yes,
and in libraries all over the world. Were somehow just selected as, would you want your children to be reading this, or what sort of man would put his name, you know, on a collection of this sort?
Exactly.
It must have been very troubling.
Well, it was upsetting. There wasn't much I could do about it because I really wasn't allowed to speak out in my defense. I finally was supported by a Republican senator
Yes, do tell people about this rather extraordinary Republican senator.
Yes, the way I got around the stricture about not to respond to these charges was through Gordon Smith of Oregon. Gordon Smith, one of two Mormons in the Senate at that time, and the other one was Orrin Hatch, both of whom said that my nomination should come to a vote in the Senate. But Gordon Smith took the further step of writing me a letter. And the letter said, Dear Mr. Hormel, it has come to my attention that you have been accused or charged with, and then he made a six-point statement and said, would you please respond to these charges? So he gave me carte blanche, in essence, to answer, which I found really quite extraordinary.
And explain in what context, as he explained to you, why it was important for him to do this.
Personally,
yes.
And privately, he said to me, you know, I've experienced prejudice, and I know what it feels like, and it does not feel good, and it is not humane, and it is not a fair treatment of individuals. So I know personally where you're coming from.
I think there could be nobody in Washington at the time, and all of us around the country, watching how stalwartly you continued to sort of stay the course. And I think many people just wondered how long you would be able to stay the course. But I think your analysis of why you did what you did and the ability that you had to do that is really something that I'd like you also to share with us.
Well, I was encouraged along the way in many different ways. But I think the most impressive to me was that every single time I went to Washington and went into the State Department building during this process, and that was quite a few times, somebody would find me. Somebody would know I was there, and they would find me and come up to me and say, Mr. Hormel, I just want you to know how what you're doing means so much to us gay Foreign Service officers. And I was so touched every time, every single time, that there was no way that I could think of not continuing. It was one time, this young man, probably in his mid-20s, presented me with a piece that he had written and wanted to get published in the Foreign Service Journal. Well, it was an attack, not scathing, but polite, but an attack nonetheless on State Department regulations which prohibited domestic partners from going overseas with their partners under any circumstance. And that was one of the regulations. There were many others, and he addressed them in this article. Well, I read it, and I got in touch with him, and I said, I wish you luck just getting this published, let alone having somebody pay attention to it. Well, he did get it published, and people did pay attention to it. And on the very last day of the Clinton administration, I was in Washington. Madeleine Albright had a reception at the State Department, which I attended, and when I got there, she came up to me and she said, I am so pleased. She said, I've just signed 13 regulations which alter the position of the State Department with respect to domestic partnerships. So there was no question in my mind that things happened.
All of those days and weeks and months of walking the corridors of the Capitol and talking to people, some unpleasant and some even more unpleasant. And your description of staying in a little hotel and fixing yourself breakfast, and of course it did say eggs and bacon and not eggs and spam, but what can we do? Every time in Hawaii there's any sort of criticism of spam as being over-salted and over-fatted and whatever the description is, there's always a defense. It's our plantation food. Looking back on these early decades of your life, I don't think you can be looking back at your life because you're much too young, but looking back at the part that has transpired so far, is there anything you would have done differently and why?
Well, that also is a very difficult question, because if I had done things differently, I don't know whether I'd be sitting here with you today or not. And I would like to think that I would have found ways to be a more honest individual. That's the thing that sticks in my craw the most. And I've learned a very dear lesson from my very dear Michael, who has really kind of instructed me on honesty and truth-telling and what happens when you don't do that.
See, it's another good Swarthmore
yes.
product, yes? The good Quaker tradition. I have to disclose I went to Bryn Mawr, so the Quakers have an influence on much of what we do. Several people are interested, given the nature of your own experiences, as to the counsel or guidance you would give young persons who are LGBT who want to go into the political or government arena. Any kind of thoughts or recommendations or advice?
Well, I think the arena is opening up rapidly, really rapidly. I remember in, I think, 1975 or 6, when Elaine Noble was elected to the Massachusetts state legislature, and she was the first. And I know that today there are over 500 openly gay people who are serving in government. But there are only 4 of them in Congress.
And one of them is stepping down.
Yes.
Barney Frank said today that he will find other ways to keep himself animated and involved.
Well, I'm sure that he'll find ways that aren't quite so severe.
For sure.
And he's done a wonderful job, and we should be very proud of him. But there aren't any cabinet officers who are gay. And I think that in itself gives something to aspire to. The president, our current president, has appointed more gay people to public service than all other presidents combined. And under his direction, we no longer have Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We have a Disabilities Act that covers the LGBT constituency. There are a number of things that have happened, but there are a couple of things which have not happened. One of them is marriage equality, of course. And I think that's going to take time, partly because so many people out there think that being gay is a choice, that we choose to put ourselves into this universe to be tormented by people who are not gay. We do not make that choice. And you know, Mary, I'm left-handed. I didn't choose to be left-handed. But it's the same thing. It's just the way I work. So when we get beyond that myth of choice, I think that things will become very much easier. Also, more and more people are open about their sexuality. And 30 years ago, I think there were something like 49% of the population who said they knew somebody who was gay, and now it's about 92%. So it's a different atmosphere in which young people may choose to go into public service. And they will find organizations like the Victory Fund who are there to support them. They will find the Human Rights Campaign, which is advocating on their behalf, and the Lesbian Gay Task Force in Washington. They will also find that Washington is a very closed-minded place, and that members of Congress, by and large, are very far behind their constituent thinking. San Francisco is an exception.
San Francisco is an exception. I remember years ago, a very nice, rather elderly taxi driver said to me that Washington, where he was born and raised, was a perfectly reasonable place until air conditioning was invented, because the people on the Hill would go home for the summer, because Washington, D.C., as you know, becomes very humid and muggy during the summer. But with air conditioning, they stayed all year. And he said, and look what happened to the nation. So we have air conditioning to deal with. Have you been happy since you've moved to California? Do you feel that California, Eureka, this is it for James Hormel?
Well, I've lived here since 1977, so that's 34 years, longer than I've lived any other place by far. And before that, of course, my grandparents were in Southern California, although
that is a
different state. But but I like that, too. And, yes, California is home.
That's wonderful. Well, we're very happy that it is your home. We have time, really, for just about one more question. But I want you to be able to reflect on it, because it's of interest to everyone here. For someone who leads such an active, engaged, busy life, I can only say, as one person who's always trying to get Jim to come to this, that, or the other thing, that your schedule has you all over the country doing so many good works, and you and Michael involved in so many wonderful things. But the question is, what do you, Ambassador Hormel, do to relax? And just relax and tell us exactly what you do in order to relax.
I take a deep breath from time to time.
But then you have to let it out. Exhaling is extremely important.
There's music in my life. And it's music which I enjoy listening to and playing.
Well, actually,
I made a CD a couple of years ago.
Oh, my goodness,
members
we should have
family.
Included it with the book. Tell us more.
The song selection is mainly from the sort of early to mid-20th century. The performers are all members of the family, including my nephew, who is a guitarist who plays professionally all the time, my eldest daughter, who's a vocalist and who has sung professionally, my son, who plays the saxophone and who lived in New Orleans for several years playing there before he moved to California, my nephew, who just got his master's degree, I believe, as a drummer at CalArts.
And what instrument do you play?
And I play keyboards, ukulele, banjo, and the slide whistle.
You know more than you ever expected to know about the Honorable James Hormel. We are so grateful to you, Jim, for being with us on this special program. We've been speaking to the Honorable James Hormel, author of Fit to Serve, The Battle to Become the First Openly Gay U.S. Ambassador. Our appreciation also goes to Wells Fargo for sponsoring tonight's program, which is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And finally, we extend our gratitude to our audiences here in San Francisco and on radio, television, and the internet. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of Jim's book are on sale in the lobby, and he has kindly agreed to sign them for you immediately following the program. But we would greatly appreciate your letting the ambassador make his way to the signing table at the end of the program before we all merge on him. I'm Mary Bitterman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.